3. Since his return to the African mine site, Johnny had had trouble getting to sleep at night. He would roll and toss on the oversized cyclo bed in the underground room he now used, uncomfortable in the overly hot and humid dark, going over and over again the steps and planning of recent past events, spotting where he had gone wrong in this and where he should have done something else in that. The life of a boy seemed far too much to pay for the information they had to have. Sir Robert was not here. He remained in Scotland organizing a perimeter anti-aircraft defense for Edinburgh. McKendrick was not here. He had taken a trip home to see to the movement of his underground hospital to more suitable quarters now available, and to check up on how his assistant was getting along. Colonel Ivan was in Russia. Stormalong had been detained here, for they were afraid some revenge might be taken upon him for lending his clothes and identity to the recent enterprise. Finding himself at loose ends, the Norwegian had kept himself busy inventorying the flying hardware, a name he had gotten from somewhere or invented for planes. Through Stormalong's efforts, Johnny had begun to divine the true character of his African base. Because it shipped very little bulk ore, they had roasted the tungsten down on the site, it had had none of the bulk ore carriers, a fact which made it necessary to truck out fuel and breathe gas from the branch mine site in the Ituri Forest. But this African Central did have a great many other types of planes, which had led Stormalong to conclude that the base had also had a defense function. From some old cyclo manuals they had found, it seemed that in event of attack upon the mine site near Denver, this African base had the function of launching a counterattack to take an enemy by surprise. And this is exactly what these cyclos had been engaged upon when annihilated. It greatly intrigued Stormalong to find several types of flying hardware he had never seen before, and which weren't listed in current cyclo manuals. They were not battlecraft as such, however. They were dual-purpose machines brought in to perform a specific task, and then, that task done, rather typical of company policy, they had simply been dollied to the back of the hangar and forgotten. Too costly or too much trouble to return them to Cyclo. According to flight logs, still with them, they had been used to mine out an enormous amount of material which was found in orbit around this planet, a circumstance unusual in Cyclo experience. Some of the metals in these objects were priceless, being very scarce elsewhere, and the company had taken the unusual step of sending in some machines. If properly gasketed in its stores, due to its teleportation motors, which had no dependence upon air for lift, any common battle plane could fly to the moon and back without too much trouble. But they were not equipped to mine in space. You couldn't take objects in and out of a battle plane while flying in a vacuum. So some factory on Cyclo or on a planet controlled by the Cyclos had converted some very heavy-duty, armored marine attack planes. With atmosphere locks and remote control grapplers, they could fly alongside some object in space, seize onto it, and put it in the hold. Some scraps of such recovered objects were still in the holds of these things, bits which had broken off, like nameplates. One said, NASA. And Stormalong tried to look it up in planetary lists and couldn't find it. Therefore, he had to conclude that it had been a local something. Johnny had looked at the old relics with some indifference. The gaskets on the doors were deteriorated. You can't expect a gasket to last for 1,100 years and still be airtight, he pointed out. Every hinge and ball joint in their cranes and doors was too stiff to operate properly. There were even some spider nests in them, and the spiders had dined for countless generations on another breed of insect that had dined upon the upholstery. The things were a mess. Johnny had been more interested in another craft, which mounted a blast cannon. But Stormalong, having some idle and recently trained mechanics and three spare pilots on his hands and full shops available, had put these relics in operating condition. He had even painted a burning torch on either side of its nose, which he said was a symbol of freedom. Stormalong had a lot of artistic style in him, Johnny had to admit. but he privately hoped the symbol didn't forecast the thing going down in flames. Not detecting the expected amount of enthusiasm, Stormalong had smugly pointed out, "Do you have anything else that could go up and visit those things orbiting 400 miles up there?" For some days now, there had been four bright objects in orbit. First, there had been one, then two, and now four. "Visit them?" said Johnny, aghast. "This thing doesn't even have guns anymore."
"We put them back," said Stormalong.
"And every screen and instrument in it works now. There were spares." "You better test fly it," said Johnny, "with a jet backpack close to hand."
"I did," said Stormalong, "yesterday. The console buttons are a bit old-fashioned, but it flies great."
"Well, don't go flying up to those objects," said Johnny.
"Oh, I didn't," said Stormalong. "I just took pictures of them."
He had them. One was a big craft with a diamond-shaped bridge and a lot of blast gun snouts. One was a cylinder with a control deck and the front flat end. One was a thing which looked like a five-pointed star with a sort of gun on each star point. And the fourth was a sphere with a ring around it.
"Hey," said Johnny, "that answers the description, the last one, of the small gray man ship. The one you did but didn't crash into."
"Precisely," said Stormalong. "We're under surveillance."
Johnny had known they were under surveillance. No enemy had a monopoly on that. They had shifted their own drone pattern and control to Cornwall, and there were repeaters here. 12 drones, flying slow around the globe, were passing the American mine site every few hours. They were also recording the objects in orbit, though not so well, for drones were basically downlooking. No, a potential enemy had no monopoly, and ground defenses were also alert. But it was minimal defense, and Johnny knew it. Tonight he couldn't sleep at all. Dunnell Dean was overdue with the first recordings of Turl's activities, and Johnny didn't even know yet whether they would get recordings. Radio chatter about their project was forbidden. He was in the dark. He got up restlessly at last and paced about. Then he went outside the compound. Hot. Muggy. A lion was roaring down by the lake. The sky was overcast. Suddenly, he was overcome with the desire for some cool air and a look at stars. There were a couple of battle planes on standby, ready for a scramble if needed, but they were defense items. The ancient relic Stormalong had repaired was near at hand, a dull green in the glow of compound lights. On impulse, wanting only to do something besides brood, he went in to the duty officer and told him where he was going and got a mask and flight suit. True enough, the controls were a bit old-fashioned. The lift balance buttons were bigger and in a different place. The gun trips had been moved to make way for the crane controls. But so what? He put on a jet backpack, strapped himself in, closed all the windows tight, and vaulted the old wreck skyward. He burst through the overcast, and there were the stars. Johnny could always get a thrill from flying. Since that first enchanting day he had been aloft, he had never lost it. The black sky and bright stars, half a moon, some snow-capped peaks close by shoving their crowns up through the overcast and into the night sky. Johnny felt some of his tension ease away. He simply enjoyed it. It was certainly cooler now. Out of habit, he scanned his screens. Some blips. He looked through the screen for a visual check. Four objects in orbit was what should be there. No, there were five. One new object was approaching the four old ones, all brighter and steadier than stars, about 400 miles up. The last thing he was going to do was go up and visit them. Unknown ships there. He was flying a relatively untried ship here. He had no support. And even if this old relic could fly clear to the moon and back, he needed no additional incidents at this time, thank you. But maybe he could get some better pictures. Stormies, taken in daylight, had been fuzzy with ultraviolet. He threw his plane up to a height of 200 miles and closer to the objects, his attention mainly on putting the recorders on standby.
What was that?
A flash from the new fifth ship?
Yes. Another flash. Were they shooting at him? Ready to take evasive action, he suddenly saw a wild flurry of flashes coming from one of the four objects and a splash of light on the fifth. Hey! The fifth ship was shooting at one of the original four, and that one was firing back. He quickly battered away at the old controls and closed the distance to about 150 miles. He was so intent on getting his recorders working, he didn't realize he was shooting in toward those ships at hypersonic maximum. Astonishing. The fifth ship and one of the original four were really having at it. Blast streaks were sheets of blue-green and red between them. Orange splashes of hits. Abruptly, he realized they were getting awfully big in his view screens. A cyclo-numbered digital was rolling up the narrowing distance. 75 miles. An instant before he pressed the console for a reverse roll and drive, the firing among the ships ceased abruptly. Johnny put his old wreck into a full power fall and got out of there. This was not his war. He didn't even know whether he had working guns. At about 100 miles above the Earth's surface, he eased off. He was about 50 miles up when he was flying level again. He looked back. They were not firing now, just sitting up there. The fifth ship seemed to have closed in on the others.